Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. I seriously love BetterHelp so much. They're one of my favorite sponsors, and I will tell you why I love them so much. When I started this podcast, I was going through a really rough time. I'm talking drug relapse, drug addiction, drug abuse, relationship issues, anxiety, depression. I was going through one of the craziest moves of my life, so therapy really helped me get through a lot of that. And online therapy is, in my opinion, even better than going to a therapist's office because, let's face it, our lives have changed the last year or so, and I just feel like online therapy is the best way to go. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you can start communicating with them in less than 48 hours. They really do match you with a therapist so quickly. It takes, in my case, less than 24 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. And there's a broad range of expertise available, which might not really be locally available in all areas. The service is available for clients worldwide, and it's super easy to access your account. You can log in, you can send a message to your counselor really at any time you want, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, whatever you prefer. I like to do phone sessions sometimes because sometimes I like to go on a walk when I do my therapy sessions. It's really up to you. Traditional therapy can come with kind of a stressful energy attached to it. So I really love how BetterHelp is really controlled by the patient. If you want to connect with your therapist and communicate something with them, they have a journal feature, which I absolutely love. This journal feature has the option of sharing your journal entries with your therapist, but if you want to keep them totally private and anonymous towards yourself, you don't have to share them with your therapist. But I really like this feature because for many of us, starting fresh with a new therapist gives us a lot of anxiety and it can trigger us. So if you feel like that, you're not alone. I felt the same exact way because let's face it, a new therapist has to ask questions and try to get on the same page as where their client is. And sometimes rehashing our history of trauma and all the details can become kind of exhausting and a little bit annoying. So what I do when I start with a new therapist, like I did on BetterHelp, is I use the journal feature and I wrote kind of a lengthy email explaining to the therapist what I've been through in the last few years, where I'm at right now, what I'm looking for in therapy, and what kind of therapy I've done, what kind of therapy I'm interested in, and what I'd like out of a therapist. So this is super important. If starting with a brand new therapist gives you panic or anxiety, or stress, this is the most stress-free approach you could possibly do. I love how they matched me with someone with the experience and qualifications that I asked for. I personally asked for a therapist who had some experience with eating disorders, depression, and relationship trauma. Once BetterHelp matched me with my therapist, she messaged me right away, and then I scheduled my first session with her for that week. The process is easy, effortless, and stress-free. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. So if you're going through a hard time right now, and let's face it, so many of us are, whether it's emotional turbulence, depression, anxiety, relationship issues, LGBTQ issues, whatever it is, body image, self-esteem, BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit betterhelp.com/vibe. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, and join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Vibe Within listeners, you get 10% off of your first month of online counseling at betterhelp.com/vibe. That's betterhelp.com/vibe. BetterHelp.com/vibe. Go start online therapy, DM me on Instagram, let me know how it's going, and I hope that you get the help, the support, and the healing that you deserve. Welcome to the Vibe Within podcast. I'm your host, Gab Cohen. Each week, we will connect through stories and conversations about wellness, yoga, addictions, spirituality, mental health, rituals, and everything in between. The goal is to transform our traumas into strengths to create the change we desire in our lives. My mission is to help others by shining awareness on real-life topics so we can learn new ways to heal physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Whatever you are going through in this moment, you are not alone, so let's connect and heal our vibe within. Cats perform oral sex on each other. If that's not a great way to start this intro, I don't know what is. How are you guys doing out there? I have some really important questions to ask, and I have some really cool things that I'm gonna go over in this intro. But yeah, first things first, I think my cats do oral sex on each other. Because my older cat, Gnar, is fixed, and he's been fixed for quite some time, but he used to hump things a lot. He doesn't really do that anymore, but then he started to do that to my newer cat, Gemini. And, you know, I obviously, like, get him off of her when he's trying to do that, but lately, when I catch them, you know, cuddling or fucking around, it seems like she enjoys it too. So it's just been interesting to witness their energy together, because Gnar is like this older man, you know, he's like 3.5 years old, so technically that's, you know, a little bit older. It's like teenage years maybe. And Gemini is not even a year old yet, so there's an age gap there, and I feel like Gemini enjoys when Gnar gives her that attention. But sometimes it's really, really cute, because Gnar will, like, give her massages, and she'll just kind of lay there, and he'll just, like, touch her stomach and her back, and sometimes he'll lick her and clean her. If you're not a cat person, I'm very, very sorry for this intro. I'm not going to talk about my cats for too much longer, but I just want to know, is this normal for cats to basically perform oral sex on each other? Because I feel like he does other things than just want to hump her. I'll just leave it at that. Anyways, how are we doing out there? I was just listening to Jessica Lignato's podcast, Ghost of a Podcast. It comes out every Sunday, and she talks about the astrological transits that are happening. And I just want to say, if a lot of you are struggling right now with a deeper, more intense depression, or this feeling of angst, or, you know, some feelings of resentment or psychological despair, anything that is shaking you up, that could be because of the Saturn square Uranus transit that happened. And we're just going through a lot of transits. It's interesting to listen to that podcast because she really ties in like a mental health aspect to it. So I recommend that. What else? I have some notes here that I wanted to talk about in the intro. Oh, okay. So there is a lot of, let's see, how am I feeling this transit? I'm feeling like this annoyance of everything, and my depression is really skyrocketing, and my anxiety is skyrocketing. Like last night, I was punching pillows, you guys, and I know that that's not something to be shameful of, but I had to punch a pillow like 4 times to release the energy. And that's a very healthy way to release energy. I hear tons of therapists and coaches and spiritual leaders and whatever talking about how important it is to release anger and just bottled up energy. And because if you don't let it out, it's going to keep bubbling inside of you. And last night I just felt so uncomfortable. I'm having a lot of hip pain. I'm having a lot of inflammation, swelling. I feel like I need to go to the chiropractor again because that shit is magical. So I just couldn't take it anymore. So I was like smoking CBD and I was like punching pillows. It's a beautiful image, right? Yeah, I'm not always like calm and love and light. And that's the problem with Instagram, is that of course my photos and what I share and what I write and how I articulate it makes it seem like I'm looking back at the times that I was anxious or depressed or dealing with disordered eating or dealing with pain or whatever. But it doesn't have to be that way. You know, when people are sharing on Instagram, it doesn't have to just be, oh, when I used to do this or when I used to feel this way. Like, things aren't that like black and white. Like, oh, I used to be depressed and now I got over it and now I don't deal with it anymore. It's like depression and anxiety come in waves, and pain and inflammation come in waves. And it's just the way that we handle it and the way that we deal with it is the way that we, you know, can articulate ourselves through our lives. But that's also what I wanted to talk about in this intro is movie recommendations and a documentary recommendation that I recently watched is Fake Famous on HBO Max, if you have it. And I really liked the documentary. I don't want to spoil it. It's not a super long documentary, but one of the people who are in the documentary, I am going to interview on this podcast. They already said they would. I'm not going to tell you who it is. I'm going to keep that a surprise, but I'm super excited to interview them. And basically the documentary just highlights and it shows perfectly how skewed this society is and how everybody is so hyper-focused on being famous and being known and being recognized. And there's a woman on the documentary who says something very, very profound, and it hit me really hard. She said, when you're an infant and when you're a child, you know, when you're a baby, everybody praises you for everything you do. You can't do anything wrong, right? Everybody's praising you, even if you do something, you know, fucked up, like you drop something on the ground and it shatters. Nobody's gonna be angry at you, you know? So a lot of this craving and this desire and this toxic, you know, need to be famous, to be well known, to be seen, and to become a celebrity of some sort, even if it's an influencer type celebrity, it roots back down and into childhood and into this need or this craving to be loved and to be heard and to be accepted and to get attention and to be praised no matter what you do. It comes from a sense of lack. It comes from a sense of, you know, mental health, depression, childhood trauma, whatever it is. But this documentary was really good. I recommend it. And then the other movie that I watched after that was The King of Staten Island with Pete Davidson. And it's directed and produced by Judd Apatow. And the cast is just amazing. Steve Buscemi's in it. Bill Burr. It's a really, really great cast. It's honestly one of the best movies that I've seen in probably years. It made me laugh and it made me cry. And it was really fucking good. Just a beautiful movie. So I recommend it. Which is, you know, when you look at the cover of it or the, you know, the marketing, you wouldn't think it's going to be this amazing film, but it really is. Anything that Judd Apatow does is pretty good. What else? Health update. I have been really focusing on health. I went to the endocrinologist finally. I had an appointment with her. And I just want to say, you guys, if you're dealing with health issues or emotional stuff, like mental health stuff, and you go to a specialist, be honest with them, because this doctor's appointment for me was very different than all the rest, because I was completely transparent with her. I told her exactly what I've been dealing with over the last decade of my life, with drugs, with alcohol, with disordered eating, with birth control, with thyroid medications, with everything. So it just made me feel really good to lay everything out on the table so that she knew exactly where I was coming from, and so that she could order the correct labs and do the correct blood work and, you know, ask me what kind of supplements I'm on. So it's really important to find a doctor that will listen to you. I was super surprised that this woman, and she was kind of young, so maybe that's why, but she spent like an hour with me, and I've never had an endocrinologist appointment spend that much time with me. So that was really nice. I have to get some more blood work. And also what I want to say is, you know, recently I was listening to the Almost 30 podcast, and in their intro, Krista was talking about how she got prescribed thyroid medication for hormone imbalance, and she was like, I don't know if I want to take it, and I just, like, don't want to, you know, have to rely on medication for the rest of my life, which is, you know, totally understandable. And I reached out to her, and I told her, you know, there is a way to just try medication out and see if it works for you, and you don't have to be a victim of how people say, oh, well, if you start medication, you're going to be on it for the rest of your life for thyroid medication. Like, that's not true. There is a way to try medication, see if it works for your body in very low doses, and also incorporate the holistic healing modalities that you're using as well, like supplements and herbs and Ayurveda and yoga and movement and breath work and just all the things that you're doing. It's not one or the other. It's not black and white. And I think this has been a huge theme and realization for me, because I'm finally realizing that if my thyroid and my endocrine system isn't working properly, then it's okay to kind of surrender and allow that help and allow that extra support to come through, even if it's in the form of a pill. Honoring the body means being truthful with thyself. I made an episode last year, Heal Thyself. I forget what it's called, but you can probably just search it on Spotify, Heal Thyself. And it's all about, being real with yourself and healing yourself through whatever it is that you need to incorporate in your life. Like, there's no shame in taking medication. At this point, if you're not familiar with thyroid and endocrine stuff, like, a lot of people deal with it, not just women. And it can take a toll on your psychological life. It can take a toll on your mental health, depression, anxiety, instability with moods, just high and low energy, fatigue. It's just too much sometimes. And I haven't been on medication for my thyroid for over 2 years because I decided to just stop taking it in, a couple years ago, just to see what it made me feel like. And I felt a lot better, and then I felt a lot worse, and then I felt better, and then I felt worse. And that cycle started to just happen over and over and over again. And now I don't even know how I feel right now. I feel okay, but I don't feel right, mentally. And there are some days physically where I'm just like, this is not, there's something wrong here, But I do want to say that it's really important to track your progress and to journal about how you were feeling this time last year or this time 2 years ago, and really see how much progress you have made, because chances are you have made a lot of changes and tweaks in your physical and mental. And it's hard to realize that when you've just been living in your body and your experience day in and day out. Like, it's hard to notice. Like, that's why people, when they start going to the gym, they'll take before and after photos, or when they're trying to lose a bunch of weight. Because when you're in your body day in, day out, you can be like, oh, well, I don't look that much different. I've only lost a few pounds. And then when you look at, like, the before and after photo, you realize how much different you do look, and how much more definition you have in your body, and how much more toned you are. And it's hard to see yourself in a new way as you're changing, because you're literally in your body and in your life, and it's hard to notice those small tweaks. Like, 2 years ago, I was living in a place that made me just depressed. I was living with roommates that were terrible. I was, going through a really hard time with my eating disorder. And when I look at my life now, I'm like, oh, wow. Like, it really brings me a lot of gratitude, and it really brings me a lot of, like, peace and hope and faith, because I can compare and contrast, like, how fucked up I was 2 years ago to now. So that's been a really nice practice for me, to just write in a list form, like, things I used to do, things I don't do anymore, things, how my life was in 2018, 2019, and how it is now in 2021. All right, what else I want to talk about? The gym. And so I have written down gym dudes. So I've been going to the gym, I've been weightlifting, and I have to say, it's so entertaining to watch the energy and be around the energy of dudes at the gym, because, I mean, obviously everybody has headphones on, everybody's in their own little world, and I swear to God, these guys get so juiced up. And they look in the mirror, and it's like they're in their own, like, music video. They have their music playing in their ears, whatever it is. But it seems like it's something pretty intense, because you can just see the look in their eyes, and they're lifting weights, and they're pumping iron, and they're, like, rocking back and forth to the music. And, like, they're just, sometimes they're, like, even rapping, like just lip syncing. Yeah, there we go. I couldn't find my words. And it's just so entertaining. And there's one guy who I actually really wanted to like tap on the shoulder and be like, dude, what are you listening to? I want to listen to that. But I thought that would be kind of weird. Yeah, just, I guess when you go to the gym, that's when you step into this alter ego rapper mentality. This is my music video where I'm pumping iron. I don't fucking know. Fuck. It's really funny. What else? I need a new computer. I'm really surprised that this computer is even hanging on. There's like 5 keys that don't work. The M doesn't work. The P doesn't work. The J doesn't work. The 4 doesn't work. I have to copy and paste those letters when I'm writing an email. It really fucking sucks. Or when I'm writing anything, I have to copy and paste it. So when I'm like writing these podcast descriptions and all the show notes, yep. So I'm saving up for a new laptop. I make all of my content and edit everything on this old MacBook Pro. And if you'd like to donate, you know, to help me support the podcast, there's a link in the show notes. Any donations appreciated. It's not necessary, but it is appreciated. If you'd like to book a tarot reading, I put that link in the show notes too, to my Etsy. If you need online yoga classes or meditations, or you're interested in doing more meditation and journaling, I have my journaling and meditation course that's in my Etsy store as well. I think that's it. So whatever you're dealing with right now, just keep in mind these astrological transits that are going on right now can definitely trigger some depression, anxiety, panic, this sense of like losing, like missing out, feeling not good enough, you know, self-worth, imposter syndrome, a lot of that stuff. I recommend going and listening to Jessica Lignato's podcast, Ghost of a Podcast. So yeah, that's it. This episode that we're getting into right now is really special to me. I got the chance to sit down and talk with Ailey Jolie, and I found her through some other podcast, I think, but she talks a lot about sex, food, the relationship with food and body, relationships, spirituality, eating disorders, trauma. Her work is very rooted in childhood trauma, and she's super into psychedelics and those types of healing modalities. We talk a lot about Buddhism and just the relationship and the connection between spirituality and sex and the relationship with our bodies and how we connect all of that to like how we were raised and our upbringing. And she definitely gets vulnerable and shares a lot of her story with trauma and sexual abuse and sexual assault. So slight trigger warning that this episode does have some of that in here. She's a really cool person. She's Canadian. I feel like I fuck with Canadian people. I love their vibe. It seems like a lot of the people that I've interviewed on this podcast have been Canadian. And a lot of my clients are Canadian too, I'm realizing. I think that I need to go to Canada. I've been to Canada once, and it was when I was 16, and it was when I was going through a really fucked up dark phase of my life, and I had a friend there, and I literally went, and that's where I did ecstasy for the first time. But I don't think that it worked because I was on antidepressants. So it was like a very weird feeling that I had. I remember we went to Tim Hortons, and I remember we went to the mall and stole shit. This girl was not a positive influence on my life. I'm surprised that her parents even let me stay there. I remember I was there for the 1st of July, which is like Canada Day, equivalent to 4th of July here. What else did we do? I went to Gay Pride in Montreal, and I remember how weird I felt, but I mean, I don't know. I was just exposed to that culture very young. This is a long time ago because I am, you know, not in my late 20s anymore. That's it. let's get into this episode with Ailey Jolie. You're really going to love it. She's so, like, calming and soothing and accepting, and just it was a lovely, lovely chat, and we get super deep, and I love how we talked about Buddhism and spirituality and how it connects to all this shit. So enjoy, and yeah. Here is Ailey Jolie. I think the first podcast I listened to you on was on Mary's Cup of Tea.
Yes.
And everything that you were talking about, from, you know, sexual trauma to sexual abuse linked to eating disorders. And around that time, I was really honing in on recovery with disordered eating and just toxic cycles and behaviors, and I was just like at my wit's end. So when I heard you talking about this stuff in such a different way, and embodiment, it was like exactly what I needed to hear. It was like so nourishing on a mental level, and it really just opened my eyes to the somatics of it of it all.
Yes, there is oftentimes such a divide between, I would say, the realm of trauma therapy, which often now at least acknowledges the role of the body. Thank you. It's been a beautiful improvement. And the realm of eating disorders. And I think the divide in the two is often just a complexity in regards to like clinicians and how we train. But the cross-pollination of those two disciplines is just doesn't happen very often. And then in that space, there becomes this gap of individuals, at least like myself or, and lots of the clients I work with, where it's like, I have this history of trauma and I'm struggling with food and body. And yet I can't find a clinician who can hold both pieces, but I know that they're somehow related and everyone kind of knows how they're related, but how they're uniquely related is as individual as every person. And I think that leads to this kind of giant divide between the two. So as a clinician, I'm constantly working with people to put those pieces together for them to find how food or body was a distraction, a protective mechanism, a coping tool, their escape, their place of artisan. Like, there's so many things that food and body can be to help someone get through something that is really overwhelming. And then there becomes a time where that mechanism needs to shift and change into something new as the trauma is more reprocessed or even looked at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, and what I've realized is that through the years of my eating disorder, it's shifted, it's breathed, you know, it's danced in and out. Like, there's been years where I didn't feel like I was engaging in too much of it, and I was engaging in drugs and alcohol and sex. Mm-hmm. And then there was years where I was, you know, dipping back into the eating disorder. But I've never thought for a moment that I've never like there wasn't a moment in my recovery between drugs, alcohol, and eating disorder that I was like eating disorder free or recovered. Mm-hmm. Which is, it's daunting at times, because with substance abuse, it's easy to go cold turkey off of something and work your steps and go to your meetings and, you know, all of that. But what you're saying is, it resonates with me really deeply, because I go to therapy and it feels like the trauma and the eating disorder, they're two separate things. When I talk to a therapist or I'm in group meetings or whatever, but they're so intertwined, and it's this gray area of like establishing like what the triggers are. And there's so many layers when people talk about trauma. So I'd love to hear kind of your personal experience with how you think your eating disorder manifested, if that makes sense, like what traumas you think, just to like kind of give an example to that.
Of course. Yes. So I definitely look back and I view food as in many ways the thing that allowed me to place all of my focus and also deeply understand the body-based violation that I was experiencing. So I have this very confined and beautiful memory. I say beautiful and I'm using it in a stretched way. It's very sacred to me, I guess is probably a more appropriate word. But the first time I was sexually abused by my uncle, I remember right after that experience going down and sitting at the table, and I ate in my little 3.5-year-old body. I ate all of the pizza that I could eat. And I remember the feverishness of eating all this pizza and feeling uncomfortable and having family commentary on how much I was eating. And in my little mind, I remember thinking, if I keep eating, if I keep saying I'm hungry, I can sit beside my mom and then I'm safe. And then I won't have to go back there. We were at the swimming pool party. I won't have to go back out there with the other kids. And then I won't be abused again. And in this way, what I was doing, which there's now a lot of neuroscience research around, and I'm super fascinated by it. Essentially, what I was doing was recreating the body-based violation that I had just experienced 45 minutes ago, but with an essence of control. So this way that my body had just been thrown into overwhelm in this experience of abuse, I was then doing the same with food, but trying to regulate the experience, trying to I'm now doing this. I'm now harming my body. I'm now filling it up to a place of discomfort. I'm now disassociating so much. I've eaten this much and I feel uncomfortable. I'm now taking back my power back by violating my body with food in a way that physiologically and neurologically mirrors how I was just sexually abused. And this link, I feel like, is the essence of, at least where I feel like there can be a lot of traction in how we work with food and body and sexual abuse. And the link between is understanding this mirroring of body-based violation that happens for people who have been sexually abused. So I look through kind of my story. And for me, even though that moment was overindulging in food, my little psyche kind of switched into a very extreme place of restriction, and it kind of, I wouldn't say flew under the radar, but because I was so young when my anorexia started, it kind of became acculturated that's the norm. And I kind of grew up in this place of, not feeling my body, kind of having grayish coloring through the eyes. I didn't see the world in full colors, and I was just so malnourished. And that was my way of kind of creating this protective bubble of disassociation, that I was hurting myself more than anyone who later went on to abuse me could hurt me, because I already wasn't there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so there was a moment, and I feel like this kind of, it might be a blanket statement with eating disorders, but it seems to me that there's a moment of lack of control. And some people are, they go through that moment of lack of control when they're very young. Most of the time it's family related. I've tended to see, I go to a lot of eating disorder meetings virtually, and it just seems that that's the case, and what I'm hearing when you explain that is the body was violated, obviously. And so the mind of the child tries to make sense of it, because deep down they knew that they were violated, but how do they know for sure? You know what I mean? Because it's a child, and the child wants to feel comfortable, so they make reasoning with the adult, or reasoning with the bullshit that's going around them, and then takes it out on the body themselves because they're in control. And I definitely relate to that for sure.
Yeah, for a little bit more clarity, kind of what happens is when we experience any form of violation, we see this in neuroscience now with neuroplasticity and habit repatterning. But if we go back to Freud, he talks about repetition compulsion, and what this concept from then that's now being neurologically validated is that when we have something that happens to us that's out of our control, we are going to recreate that scenario either physiologically in how it feels in our body. If that's going to be dating someone who looks like an ex, going to another work environment that has toxic kind of feminine energy, it doesn't matter. We're going to go and find this. Our central nervous system is going to tune to create that state in essence and in hope that we can have a different experience. So with food, what I was trying to do by overeating was recreate the physiological kind of dysregulation, painful state, in hopes that if I was doing it, maybe it would be different. Maybe there would be a different ending. Maybe I would be able to control it and get that resolution. So in this way, even though it's like kind of backwards that we end up mirroring the things that are most painful for us or dating the same guy again and again and again, if we use that example, it's really coming from this strong desire innately in the psyche to heal. Mm-hmm. But it gets looped in the trauma and in the dysregulation and in the overwhelm, and it kind of loses its footing of how to do that exactly.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the spirit or like the soul is trying to like fix something that like scratching an itch, you know, that you can't reach or something. Like you're trying, like, and I love the term of stuck in a loop. Not that I love being stuck in a loop, but I feel like that just explains it so well. I mean, I feel like even though I'm 30 years old and I, you know, am not doing the same things that I was doing when I was in my anorexia phase in high school, I'm doing things that are similar in a different way. Like the eating disorder behaviors has transformed as I've grown and gotten older, and maybe I'm not doing them to a T like what I was doing in high school, thankfully, because I was very, very ill. But they manifest in different ways, but like the patterns and the cycles are kind of the same still.
Mm-hmm. And that is kind of that place that goes into the space of embodiment, and where I got really curious. Last year I was taking a program through Harvard Medical School, and it was all around trauma recovery. And I kind of left and I had this place of like, okay, so I feel very confident in knowing how to do trauma reprocessing, but I don't know how to give my clients a new experience, which is what you're speaking to. It's like, if we don't give an embodied sense of pleasure or ease or satisfaction or containment, any of these kind of basic fundamental feeling states in the body that trauma avoids or an eating disorder completely washes away, if we don't give those to someone and really ground that in, then yes, this loop is going to continue and continue and continue. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other way that psychotherapy and psychology is now moving and has some awareness of like, therapy shouldn't just be hard. It should actually feel good. People that are coming to therapy probably know pain and they probably don't know pleasure. So maybe we need to sprinkle that in there. But it speaks to that loop. And the more embodied experiences you have of something different, the more your body is going to be able to shift between those two states and ideally get off the loop.
I love that you said new experience, because like, you know, the body and the mind kind of don't know any better. Like they don't know any other way, because I can't really remember how my life was before my eating disorder. Like I was so young. And so my question is, for people who are safe and like for example, for me, my life is pretty good right now, if I'm comparing it to when I was in the midst of my eating disorder. But I still have an eating disorder. Even though my life is, from an outside perspective, you know, I'm financially more secure, I have animals, I make a living, I am an adult, and like all this, and like, but there's still those remnants that want me to go back into my eating disorder and hyper focus and obsess about weight and weight loss and this and that and the way that clothes fit and fucking it's just crazy. And so my question for you is, how can you help a client cultivate safety and calm, like in the body, when in your patient, when somebody's feeling very physically uncomfortable or just distraught, like physically?
Yeah, so I have a kind of a two answers to your question. The first one, directly, like if someone is feeling a lot of discomfort in their body and that is bringing up a lot of food and body-based thoughts, anyone who works in somatics really acknowledges that saying be in your body is kind of one of the most oppressive statements that you can make. The body stores our trauma. Don't ask people to go there unless you can actually safely take them there and you can hold the container for them to be there. So I always say to clients, if you're feeling uncomfortable in your body or that's really overwhelming, specifically those that struggle with food and body, that's totally okay. There are beautiful resources that we can use for the mind to activate that sense of calm, to tap on that insular lobe, to alter the state of consciousness so you have more ease and more regulation through your central nervous system. Because for lots of people, myself included at one time, being in my body was just not a place that ease was going to exist. And so it's changing the narrative and some of that judgment that comes around, oh, like I have to be in my body to be calm, or like that's where all the good calm exists. It's like, no, no, no. There's way that you can use the mind to engage in that way. One client specifically comes to mind, very well in her recovery, wonderful to work with. And this client at that time still had a lot of food and body-based thoughts. Body felt really uncomfortable. And that rapid kind of thinking, we strategized together. And I was like, every time that rapid thinking comes on, that's your wonderful mind that's curious and explorative and wants to learn and just has a lot of energy and it's putting it on food and body. Could we harness that energy somewhere else? Could you shift that into reading a book? Could you just let yourself fully get immersed in something else in that same way? And for her, that was a really beautiful kind of transition point of like, every time I start obsessing, I'm just going to think that my mind is a little hyper and I'm going to go grab a book and I'm going to go sit down. Another client, it was art, and it was using and focusing and really bringing the mind into a whole system with the body. Because if we felt anxious energy in our legs, most of us would be apt towards movement. But when we feel anxious energy in our mind, there's a judgment of it, when actually it's just, you know, it's one part of the body that's experiencing something. So I always say that to people who feel uncomfortable in the body. I'm like, where is the discomfort? How can we mobilize it? How can we find that regulation again? Yeah. Second piece of your question, I feel, really touches on the definitions of what is recovery and what is the standard that we are asking or desiring of ourselves when speaking of recovery from food and body. After working in this field, I feel like oftentimes there's this expectation that I'll never have another food thought, I'll never have another body thought, or I'll never struggle. And I see this rhetoric coming a lot from therapists who are recovered or nutritionists who are recovered. Like, it just doesn't exist. And I worked with a nutritionist very early in my journey, and she said to me, and I didn't like it at the time, and I was like, I don't like this statement, but it's brought me the most solace now. She said, the eating disorder will always be a door. There'll always be a door inside my mind to walk down. And some days when things are really tough, I may open that door and look around just to feel comfort. Mm-hmm. But I no longer just have one doorway to walk down. She's like, I have lots of other doors that I can go sit in. And I like this analogy because it makes it less restrictive around what recovered looks like, because that restrictive black and white thinking of what is and isn't is the essence of what food and body struggles are based on. So I always kind of touch in those two places with clients when we're talking about still feeling uncomfortable in the body, despite lots of time in recovery and such forth and a lot of growth. It's like, okay, where are we with these two things?
Yeah. When you were talking about that, it just reminded me of the different mind states that can come with different stages of your eating disorder. Like, you know, when I was in the midst of it in high school, I was forced into treatment and I was the problem in the family. Like, I can't believe you're doing this. Do you see what you're doing to us? Like, and it's just, it's kind of funny because the reason why I was leaning into my eating disorder and restriction and losing a bunch of weight was because it was my coping mechanism from the trauma and the bullshit that was happening in the family dynamic. So I always like to say, if the person's not ready, then they're not ready. Just like addiction. But when it's life and death, it's different. That's why I was forced into a facility. But what really pissed me off back then is that, I mean, an eating disorder treatment back then was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So I got this energy from the whole experience that it was my fault and, you know, how could you be doing this to yourself? And instead of everyone changing, like the family dynamic changing and my mom and my stepdad changing, because that was the trigger, and it, to this day it still is. Instead of, you know, the entire equation, like the whole family sitting down and understanding that it takes two to tango, you know, that I felt like I was the one that needed to change, and I was pinpointed, and that's not a fun place to be. And then that's when rebellion occurs. And for me, I quote unquote recovered from my eating disorder in their terms, because I was a healthy weight. And it's so sad to me when people go through treatment and then they say, oh, well, nobody's really worried about me anymore because I'm a healthy weight, you know, but they're still suffering, maybe even worse, which is a huge misconception of eating disorders. You don't have to be underweight to have one. You don't have to be underweight to be suffering. And what came up for me when I heard you talking about that is just like, so the different mind states. So now I'm an adult, and at this point I feel like my eating disorder is holding me back. It's torturing me. Mm-hmm. It's that nagging, you know, it's that part of me and that voice that just won't fuck off. And before, in high school, that I loved it, you know, it was like giving me a high. It was, you know, it was that addiction to control of the body, of restriction, blah blah blah. And now, like, it's manifested in different ways, and I'm older, and I can see it in a new way because I'm smarter now and I have more knowledge about mental health and the neural pathways and how it's so ingrained in my brain that in order for me to, like, those I love hearing people talk about neuroplasticity and the neuropathways, because it just makes so much sense. It's like those grooves in the brain are so deep that it's like, you know, how can we unpave them and then repave them? And then, you know, it's like, it's really hard to decipher who I am without the eating disorder. Like, what's my preferences? What are my actual feelings and thoughts? And circling back to the embodiment piece, it kind of makes me think, like, okay, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Like, when I wake up in the morning and I feel like shit in my body, like my hip is fucked up and I'm feeling a lot of tension there and I'm swollen and I'm puffy, then that triggers my mind to feel anxious, to feel angry, to feel irritable and wanting to jump out of my skin. But if I wake up in the morning and I feel quote unquote thin, which this sounds terrible, but this is just how the eating disorder mind works. So if I have like a quote unquote thin day, or like I'm feeling light in my body and I don't feel gross, then I'm like allowed to be happy. Do you have clients who've had that kind of mentality?
I've definitely worked with people who, yes, for sure, when they're in that place with food and body struggling, the perception or sensations that come with feeling lighter in their own skin, yes, can definitely trigger that place of euphoria. We also know that restriction releases different neurochemicals in the brain that lead to a more elevated state, specifically for the first 72 hours. After the first 72 hours. And so there are these neurochemical components that I won't get into too much, but definitely those are a huge piece. And when I have a client who's struggling in that way, what I often go back to is really this deeply rooted training and just like self that I have is the place of like mindfulness. So like if you wake up in the morning and you feel like shit in your body, it's that curiosity of like, what parts of me feel actually uncomfortable right now? And if I hold my awareness on that body part that feels gross, or this piece of me that I'm just feels really heavy, or I'm uncomfortable in me, if I hold my focus there, if I stay with the discomfort, what happens next? Can I stay with myself long enough to be in the unknown and patiently wait for something new to emerge? And if that can be done without the mind jumping in and applying a story, the body does have this way of unwinding itself and moving its own fluidity through to create a different feeling state. And so although challenging specifically at someone is at the first portions of their food and body recovery, if we use that word, it's definitely a tool that can be used, not even for those who are at the later stations, later portions of their recovery, but really for anyone and anyone who has a body that has those cycles that come from societal shame around what our body should or should not look like. That's so ingrained in all of us. And the biggest antidote I've seen clinically in my work and research wise is the application of curiosity and that willingness to stay in the discomfort, waiting for the emergence of something new.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's the thing, is that nobody wants to feel uncomfortable. And I feel like this whole human experience is just everybody is on a mission to feel at ease.
Yes.
And like, that's the fucking, like, that's just, everybody is just trying to feel okay and feel at ease and feel comfortable. And like, I'm really into Buddhism, and I go to like Dharma recovery meetings, and it's very deeply rooted in Buddhism, and how it's just, all of it is don't attach to happiness, don't attach to failures. Don't, like, it kind of sucks, because it's like, okay, well, what can I feel? Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about body, it's like, and eating disorders in particular, that voice, and after so many years of dealing with it, it's like, okay, well, if I can't trust what I look like in the mirror because I have body dysmorphia, or just because the eating disorder just really doesn't have a true grasp on what I look like, then what can I trust? You know, if I can't even trust myself with my thoughts, then how can I override that voice and start to repave those neural pathways? And how can I be okay with sitting with the discomfort?
When I hear clients, or even as you kind of named right there, like, I can't even trust my thoughts, the place that I go oftentimes is, okay, if you feel like you can't trust your thoughts, why did you think you ever could? And just acknowledging, like, 70,000 of the thoughts that we have each day, of like 100,000, I think it is, are old thoughts. They've been there for a very long time. There's no new information coming in there. And acknowledging that, like, 0.00001% of the stimuli around us is actually filtered through the mind. The rest is filtered through the body. So if you're having these, like, very vicious body-based thoughts about how you appear or how you feel, the place that I go is like, okay, the mind is in that experience right now. That's where your attention keeps going. What else is going on right now? Because for you to notice those thoughts, or for you to have a judgment that you can't trust them, there is a different observer happening. There is another piece of awareness. And maybe that awareness isn't mind-based. Maybe it's sensation-based. Maybe it's noticing your breath, and that's when you hear the thought inside, there's something else inside. And what happens if you trust that instead, or trust your gauge that you can't trust your mind right now? And it's this, like, subtle kind of pulling apart of things, and further pulling apart this conception from capitalism that, yes, life should be easy and easeful. And the curiosity I always have when I hear that from someone is like, why would you want to live a life that's sedated? It doesn't make sense to me. Life should have these ebbs and flows of things that are painful and pleasurable, and our capacity to hold the pain will directly mirror our capacity to hold the pleasure. And so, can I really be with myself in that pain when I'm having that body discomfort we spoke about a few moments ago? Can I notice the pain of my thoughts right now and be in that fully without losing myself completely in it? And there's a subtle difference there that makes all of the difference when we're speaking about be an embodied kind of eating disorder or food and body recovery.
Like, the word surrender just came up when you were talking about that. And I feel like that's such a loaded word, especially in, like, the spiritual community, like, just surrender and everything will be fine. And, it's like, but how? Like, if you know, I'm asking these questions as if somebody's just in the trenches, you know. And there's moments where I'm in the trenches still, and there's moments and days where I'm like, I'm doing this. I'm so much better. And I think that's part of the dance of recovery. It's like not linear, but like what you just were saying, something came into my mind. I'm not sure why, but you triggered something in a good way, because with like the feeling of the discomfort, I kind of know that moment in my childhood where I first started getting uncomfortable in my body. And it was obviously when I was going through puberty and I was gaining weight. And I remember like looking at a picture of me before I was gaining weight, and I was like, oh, I just want to look and feel like that, because I wasn't going through puberty. And that's why I linked being smaller to feeling comfortable.
I'm curious, like, is that time in your life, like, there was lots of discomfort or like elsewhere, or mostly it all got localized in the body, or?
So it was both, because yeah, like, yes, I was uncomfortable in my body because of the puberty, but also I was in a very unhealthy and toxic family dynamic. My mom went bankrupt. She lost her house, and we had to move in with my stepdad, who is like just a very toxic person. And me and my sister were kind of just like thrown in the trenches. Like, we had to live in this house with this man that we didn't even like. So there was a lack of control there, and my mother, just that whole dynamic really traumatized me. So just being in that house and being around that, and it ended up just being not a good place to live, because he's emotionally and mentally abusive and manipulative, and he's a narcissist. So it ended up that being in that dynamic in that house was the ultimate trigger for my anorexia. And that's when I that's when it happened. And then when I went to treatment, that's after I got out of treatment, I realized that I couldn't live there anymore. So that's when I started living with my father, and my father is awesome. I have a really great relationship with him, but that is the basis of my eating disorder, pretty much, is the toxic family dynamic with my mom and my stepdad, and feeling it not in control and her being controlled. And it was just all of it.
Oftentimes specifically when working with someone who's in a family dynamic, I don't work with youth anymore, but I'll still work with those who are like maybe like 17 to 20. And so they're still kind of fresh in their family dynamic, or still deeply connected to their parents in different ways. And a lot of the work that I end up doing is deconstructing kind of this narrative you mentioned at the beginning, that it's like, there's something wrong with the child and there's something happening there and everyone needs to look there. And instead helping them see, as well as their family, and in doing some psychoeducation, that what we know about food and body struggles or eating disorders or anxiety, OCD too, as well, is that the child actually manifests the symptomology of what else is happening in the family system. So if we have a family system that has a lot of anxiety or a lot of secrets, or there's things pushed away, it makes sense that a child would sense that in their body and then kind of act that out for the whole family system. And so in this way, the child kind of becomes the mirror of everything else that's going on. Instead of them being the problem, they're actually the opportunity for resolution for the rest of the family, because they've manifested all of this in their body and in their psyche and how they show up. So that kind of mirrors your experience. It's a very different frame than how eating disorders were treated maybe even 10 years ago in residential places. But thankfully, that narrative of the child being the dysfunctional one is changing, thankfully. Not helpful. Right.
Because it's like that child is kind of like the scream for help for them, but also the scream for help for something to change within the family. Because it's not like a kid just has a perfect life and then decides, oh, I'm gonna have an eating disorder. But I also will say, You know, perhaps my dance background also triggered it, because when I was a young girl, I was in dance and I did compare my body quite a bit, but it didn't manifest into an eating disorder until I was triggered in that family dynamic way. So maybe it was like cooking and like ready, yeah. If that makes sense. And
oftentimes I've worked with a lot of people in the entertainment industry, a lot of dancers from my own background in dance. And that's often what I hear. It's oftentimes not necessarily that the dance environment brought the thing forward. It laid all of these behaviors kind of there in the background. It like set the stage. And then there was something that happens and all like the lights come on and the stage of the eating disorder performance is just like fully enacted. And that's what I kind of hear again and again about those environments like dance or entertainment or modeling. It's like they lay this foundation that still needs some kindling. And I feel like that is kind of a mirror of societally what we see again and again and again, is the societal messages kind of lay this all out, but there needs to be some type of activation for someone to really fall into that level of looking for salvation through food and body, looking for an escape.
Yeah. Man, so I know that I'm not the only one here listening in this scenario, because so things were different back then, you know, when we're younger and we're self-destructing, whether it's, you know, toxic behavior, eating disorder, drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever. But now fast forward and say, you know, we're adults and our life is better, but if there's still toxicity occurring in our family dynamic, even from afar, that can be enough of a trigger to not fully recover. Would you say that that's still a underlying issue of many people trying to recover?
Absolutely, yes. I think that some of the if there was one part of my job that I would feel is sometimes disheartening, and this would be the one, and I talk about this and those I do supervision with and colleagues, it's really seeing, I work with those who are femme identifying, so I'll use that language, seeing someone who is femme identifying really struggling and really working really, really hard to change their life, to heal, to recover, to have a different experience, and other people in the family system just not understanding, not getting it, not knowing they're participating in it through their lack of kind of engagement or involvement, or, you know, a lot of times in the experiences of sexual violence, like perpetuating more violation by not believing someone or not honoring them or not sharing their story and being transparent. And I see the same thing with food and body kind of going on. And we know research-wise, like if your mother struggles from an eating disorder, you are, you know, have a 50% chance of hereditarily taking that on. Nature, nurture, we don't know, but we do know it runs in family systems. And that makes it very hard to live a different life when you don't have a different experience of how life could be lived.
Yeah, like you don't know how things could be if you haven't seen it or experienced it. So it's really hard to grasp. Mm-hmm. And it's sad. It is sad because, I mean, I don't like to keep bringing up my experience, but it's just kind of, it'll help people relate, because for me, I was living with my mom and my stepdad during COVID, and it was very fucked up because, like, you know, I'm 30 years old, and then all these things were resurfacing and triggering me, and I was like, yeah, this is why I had an eating disorder. This is how it developed, being around this. Mm-hmm. So it was... humbling, and it was a learning experience to say the least. And I got out of there, and it's very, I don't know the word. It's just very, disheartening. Like you said, because my mom is not changing and my stepdad's not changing. And, it's hard for me to break past that layer or that plateau. When I continue to get triggered by the things she says or the things that she does. And that's interesting that you said that eating disorders, if your mom has one, you have 50% chance, because I do think that my mom had and has one, not your typical eating disorder, but I mean, our parents are baby boomers. And back then, I don't think eating disorders were like studied or labeled or understood at all. And just, when I look back, I think that maybe she did have disordered eating. So it makes complete sense as to why maybe I was the lucky one to get it in my family. But it's just, how can you help a client who is doing all the work and the shadow work and the trying to heal physically and journaling and all these things, you know, but that one piece, their family isn't changing and they're triggered, and maybe it's politics related, maybe it's sexual abuse related. How do you help them continue on that healing path, even though the toxic family dynamic is still there that maybe triggered them to get that in the first place?
I deeply encourage my clients to find those connections elsewhere. And I just look to, I'll speak to my experience on my mother's side of the family. There's lots of women, lots of female connection available to me, but not welcoming or not open to having a conversation around sexual violence. I essentially disclosed my story and like lost them just out of discomfort, out of their own discomfort, not cruelty or lack of kindness. They just could not handle it because it touched too much of their own lived experiences in different ways, very different ways, but still. And so for myself, kind of going through that, and I'm so grateful for my therapist at the time, she deeply encouraged me to go really invest in female and feminine connections to have the experiences that I was never going to have from my family, to have the experience of going over to my yoga teacher's house. And she's like, here's Brené Brown's book and I made your lemon tea. And what would you like to talk about this week? Like, how are you doing with things? Or I'm having Thanksgiving. Are you coming? Or I've noticed you at yoga class lately and you're looking a little thin. And she's one example of many, many, many women who stepped into that role of what we would perceivably call like aunt or big sister or older cousin or mother or grandmother, and offered me that thing that my family system was never going to offer me. It wasn't going to happen. And I'm actually really grateful that I had a therapist who was probably too blunt in other ways, but in this moment, she kind of just said, like, to me, straight to the point, you're not going to get this from your family. If you want that type of connection, you're going to have to find it somewhere else. Where would you like to find it? And do you want to start finding it today? And I was like, okay, like my therapist is telling me my family's not going to give me what I want. And I've spent 20 years with them and I'm not seeing anything. So I think I'm going to go try. And I think that attitude of agency and autonomy and also acceptance, because it's not a place of like, I'm trying to get you to change, or I'm resisting, or you're wrong, or I'm more developed. It's none of that. It's just like, I accept that you're here and I am here. And my needs are this and this, and you can't give me this and this, but they can. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that I am judging you or upset with you or dislike you or disowning you. It just means the things that I need are not things you can give me. And actually, in standing in that place, I'm doing the most accepting, loving, compassionate thing for our connection in this present moment and our connection for it to ever be, is by just radically accepting what is and what is not and getting what I need where I can get it.
Oh my God, yeah. Because if we're constantly on this treadmill, running on this treadmill to like get them to change in the way that we feel like they need to change or the way that they need to be, but they don't, that's like a never-ending mission and it's exhausting. And like, I love that idea of like, I guess it's like recreating your, like, since your mother or since your aunts or your family couldn't give you what you needed, you're like reparenting and like finding a new channel to like recreate that experience that you needed.
Mm-hmm. And it's sticky and it's hard work. And as a clinician now guiding people through it, I've never seen someone gracefully go through this process. It's hard. These are like deep wounds. It takes a lot of internal love to say, I'm just gonna accept that this is my need. And even though I'm so socially and culturally conditioned to think that you are the only person in the world who can meet it for me, that's actually not true.
Yeah, because that's suffering. I mean, in Buddhism, I hate to like keep bringing up Buddhism, but the constant attachment to an outcome or the constant trying to get something to work, that is suffering.
Absolutely, yes. And it's oftentimes the more we strive for something, the more we end up doing the exact behaviors that push it away. So Buddhism definitely applies here, and non-attachment, and that deep practice of metta or loving kindness is like so fundamental when we're talking about family systems.
Yeah, metta is something that I'm really trying to cultivate, and like they call it radical acceptance for a reason, because it feels fucking crazy and it feels radical. It does not feel normal at all to sit here and say, okay, well, my mom is the way that she is, and she's going to continue to not realize that she's emotionally kind of abusing me in these ways of choosing my stepfather over me, or choosing, you know, this over me. And but what came up for me when you were saying, like, you just have to kind of accept that they are that way, is that maybe my mom doesn't know any better. And that's the piece that might help people be able to cultivate radical acceptance and compassion towards their family members who don't realize what they're doing. Because for my mom, it's like, if I want to take it back to when this all occurred, it's like she lost her home. She felt probably out of control, and she married this fuckface, my stepdad, because she was probably forced to. She probably didn't know any other way, and maybe she was just trying to financially protect her and her kids. So when I think, and that's in my subconscious, like, I know this, but at the same time, I'm like, but that's not okay. So it's like this dance, but at the end of the day, what this is saying, and what you're saying so beautifully, is that acceptance is the only way, really.
And it's deeply uncomfortable, that place of just accepting this is what it is. And you mentioned something else, that place of acknowledgement of, like, I don't know the conditions around someone's behaviors or why they're acting the way that they are, but I can hypothesize, or I can speculate, or I can do some of that compassionate inquiry into considering maybe they are doing the best that they can, or maybe they don't have the tools, or they don't know any different just yet. And that doesn't ever excuse the action someone takes, but it does allow us to move more deeply into a place of acceptance from which we can create barriers or boundaries or whatever is appropriate to shield the consequences of their actions, or the consequences of them living in their unconscious.
Yeah, because they're in their unconscious for the most part. I mean, if they're not realizing or recognizing how they're hurting their child or their family member, it's like they don't have the tools or the language to change. And, like, you know, going back to like the neuropathways and trauma, and, you know, not knowing another way. I mean, our parents are on a different energy frequency. It's like, this is the way that it is, you know. I've tried to chip away at my mom. I lived with her and my stepdad for about 7 months, 8 months. And believe me when I say I was chipping away every day at what I could, you know, trying to get in there, trying to get her to see, you know, in this way that, you know, how do you not understand? And I just have a lot of empathy for people who are permanently living with family who just, I'm not going to say they're never going to change, but it's just a very, very big pile of rocks that you're moving, and it just seems like it's never ending.
Change is often challenging and slow. At least authentic change that lasts is slow.
and especially during all of these changes that are happening, you know, politically. I know you're in Canada, so I'm jealous of you. And kind of on a lighter note, I've been binge watching Handmaid's Tale, which I mean is just a very, very dark show, but mm-hmm. kind of, I don't know if you've seen it, but the whole politics and there's sexual abuse and the government threw everybody out and pretty much redominated and everybody's trying to go to Canada. So I don't know. That's just foreshadowing.
Yes, definitely the world is in a state of flux and shifting.
Do you have a lot of clients who are in America or a lot of your clients mainly in Canada?
All of my clinical therapy clients are for the most part BC based. Actually all of them are. And then all of my coaching clients, most of my coaching clients are based in the United States or overseas. So I do work with people that are across borders, but more in the realm of coaching, which looks more like embodiment practices or sexuality, more in those spaces than specific trauma reprocessing. So it's a little bit different work, but I deeply enjoy it. So I get to hear lots about what's going on over there and how it's impacting people.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. That's interesting. I mean, I'm kind of curious how that looks like in your work, your life coaching and the embodiment. Like, what if I were a new client, what would that look like?
When speaking about embodiment, the first kind of step is getting an assessment of where someone is with their body, what their relationship is, if it's struggled with food and body or addiction or toxic family systems. It's acknowledging all of the ways that one has moved out of their body and doing a lot of psychoeducation around different types of trauma, big T trauma, little T trauma, and then kind of exploring sensations and moving into the body and finding those barriers and blocks. And that's kind of the space of embodiment. It's usually with the clients I work with, it's more of a place of curiosity. It's oftentimes, I said, related to sexuality, like I don't experience pleasure or I can't reach an orgasm or when I'm having sex, my mind goes here. And so then it becomes a lot of mindfulness-based work and re-engaging the body in like a holistic and full way.
That's interesting. I feel like I would be the perfect candidate because I've been celibate for the past year and a half. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because now a lot of people have been celibate, not trying to, but because of the pandemic. And it's not funny, but I do laugh because I hear a lot of podcasts and people talking about how long they've gone without sex. And some of it is to heal and to like cleanse because, I mean, I do have sexual trauma and sexual assault trauma and toxic relationships with men in the past. And my way of healing through it was just to be completely celibate. And now I'm in this space of, okay, well, when I am ready to have sex, how's that going to happen? Like, one, I don't drink and do drugs anymore. And I don't put myself into a sobriety box because, hey, I'm going to a wedding next weekend and I'm going to have a drink probably. But I am in this space of like, okay, well, what does like sober-ish sex feel like? What does it look like? How do you engage with someone when you're just being who you are? And sex is such a weird thing when you're trying to like move through the trauma that's sexual related too. So that's really interesting that you do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do a lot of work in that realm, and it really comes from that place of acknowledging like moving through trauma, yes, requires reprocessing, but it also requires repatterning and having new experiences and finding that fluidity between pain and pleasure. So ideally, regardless of what state you're in, there's still a part of the self that's holding on to a sense of peace or a sense of understanding or acceptance that this too shall pass. Joy is going to pass. Sorrow is going to pass. Can we observe both with the same level of attachment?
And not get attached to either the suffering or the bliss, because when that happens, then you're bound to suffer more.
Absolutely.
It kind of is just like this constant, like, just jumping from one thing to another. And that's why I guess they say neutrality is the best in, you know, in Hermeticism and Buddhism. It's like the neutral way is the best, because then, you know, you're not suffering. But at the same time, like, this is a new age, and I feel like it's, you got to find that balance of being excited for things and how much of that is too much excitement and attachment and expectation. And like, I think grasping that balance is such a invigorating thing. When you can cultivate that balance, it's like nothing's throwing me off. Like, I'm not gonna go crazy over this if it doesn't go okay. And I don't know, like, what's been, I know we're getting to the end, but what's been like the biggest plateau or roadblock in your healing practice and in your journey?
Ironically, not ironically, definitely the space of sexuality. I, for a really long time, after kind of going through eating disorder recovery and feeling very confident in that, I remember I was walking down the street one day and I was like, oh my God, I am like rampage thinking of men right now. And I just kind of had this like gaspy moment. And I was like, oh my God, this feels like how I used to think about food. And I like ran to my therapist later that day and I was like, blah, blah. And she was like, yes, I've been telling you this for a year subtly, like glad you got the message walking out of the subway. And that for me was then kind of this moment of like, okay, removing the attachment that I had to men and the external validation that I would get. And in lots of ways, romantic relationships with the right kind of mindset can mirror eating disorders. And I say mindset because you can apply the same dysfunctional stuff anywhere that you go. And so then there was a kind of a phase in my life where I worked the realm of relationships and felt more secure there and confident there. But the realm of sexuality and sexual intimacy for me was kind of this place of plateau, where even though I had all this history of sexual trauma, for me, sex didn't feel disembodied. It felt really empowered. It felt all of these things. And you know, I would go to therapists and they would kind of question me on it and ask me about it. And I didn't really have anything juicy to say. I was like, I don't know why this one part of my life feels untouched, even though that's where all of the stuff is. And what I had found was that I had just really developed a beautiful way of socially falling into the sexual scripts and being disassociated, but not too much. And kind of where I found my plateau was having a partner, an experience of sexual violence later in my life that really called me into questioning and being curious and really deeply looking at the space of sex really authentically and honestly. And for me, it's sexuality is this place where I can really know how I'm doing with myself by how connected I am to my sense of sexuality, or we say the erotic, which just means your life force energy. So I just, sexuality and life force energy for me are kind of interchangeable. But I would say the biggest plateau, or the place where I'm constantly finessing and finding that edge, is in the realm of sexuality, is in that space of partnership, is in that space of play. Because to have any really deep and meaningful sexual connection, the premise of that is really being in your body. And to really be in your body in such an intimate and raw way, you really have to know your unconscious and your shadow and your triggers and the stuff that's stuck in the bottom of the basement that no one wants to look at. That is the stuff that will come up in the space of sexuality. So I would say for me, that's kind of where I'm constantly working and expanding and growing. And my path there has been a wibbly wobbly. I went and sat in silence last year for almost 2 months and had like this experience of spontaneous orgasms. And I was like, this is not why I came here, but this is beautiful. And then it kind of led me to realize like, oh yeah, I'd sat all this time in silence and being in my body after this experience of sexual violence that had happened previously in my kind of adult but still therapeutic kind of career, and processing that, reconnecting with my body so intimately and having it have all those sensations of pleasure without any imagery, without any touch, that made me go, oh, there's a different way of being with the body that actually is so delightful, but it requires so much intimacy, so much self-trust, so much self-insight, so much time. And so that's kind of where I'm constantly playing and expanding and growing. And there's oftentimes people have the misconception, because I write about sex and sexuality a lot, and it's a big part of the work that I do.
I love everything you write. Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
There's this misconception that I'm passionate about sexuality, which is true in part, but what I'm most passionate about is just being in the body. And mm-hmm. sex and sexuality is this one space that capitalism tells us that we should feel pleasure, we should play, we should have fun, and where we get that. And so I kind of use that as a leverage point to get people to become curious to be in their body through this one space in society that says, here in the bedroom, you should feel something. And to feel in the bedroom, you have to feel everywhere else. You have to be in your body. So that's kind of, yeah.
I relate to that so much because, yeah, and it's not like you're going out there and saying everybody should just have sex and be okay with it. Like, you're saying you should be okay, like, to be in your body. And then once that happens, then the doors will unlock to
everything.
Feeling comfortable in sexuality. And it's just, there's so many layers, you know, mm-hmm. like I'm right there with you, because now I'm in this realm of recovering from body related and food related things, which sexuality is all body, and mm-hmm. it's all confidence, and it's all like knowing who you are and finding that trust to open up to somebody. It takes time. And I love what you said about how you went to go sit for 2 months and you're having these orgasms. I have been celibate, like I said a few moments ago, and I also don't really masturbate because that's just my own trauma. Like, I just don't really enjoy it. I have done it before, for everyone who's listening. Like, yes, I have done it. And but I have dreams where I orgasm. Mm-hmm. And it happens quite frequently. And I think that's my body signaling, like, hey, like, it's okay, mm-hmm. you know? So it's really interesting to feel my body being activated after this, like, long, quote unquote, like, sit. Like, it's as if I've been in a retreat for the past year and a half of no sex.
Yes. I love that.
So everybody, if you want to have, you know, orgasms in your sleep, just don't have sex and your body will do it for you.
Something like that.
I don't know. I think my body is just like, yo, if you're not gonna fucking go do it, then we're just gonna have to figure it out. But where can everybody find you? And if they wanted to, like, book a session with you, and I know that you do Zoom sessions and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can find me online at Ailee Jolie. That's my Instagram. That's my website. Super simple. I keep it easy. In regards to booking, as soon as you go on my website, there's a link there. You'll see it. If you have any questions, again, super simple. It's just info@aileejolie.com.
We'll put this all in the show notes too.
Yeah, super simple.
Yeah, and your Instagram always has beautiful quotes and words of wisdom and just very light and airy. That's the energy that I feel when I look at it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
It was lovely to be here.